I'm tempted to do a cultural joke. How many Brits are in the room? It's Friday, it's 5 to 5, and it's Cracker Jack.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry, but, you know, I've sat through 2 days of US jokes and US anecdotes. I can't resist it. Cracker Jack was a great program when I was a kid, and it was on Friday at 5 to 5, it was Chow's program, and they always pulled something magic out of the hat. Well, I don't think we have to pull anything more magic out of the hat than synthetic biology. I mean, it is the magic thing that's been pulled out of the hat. I mean, certainly I'm convinced of that. What we want to do in this last session, though, is just bring the moderators, and as you'll see in a couple of places, the moderators have immoderately got on aeroplanes and headed off back home, so we have a couple of august replacements in here. What I want to do is just simply turn to the panel, one by one, in an undisclosed order, so I can keep that frisson of unexpectedness amongst them, to hear from them what they think are some of the key messages they've heard, and one recommendation. The reason I want one recommendation is I'm going to reverse order a little bit, and I'm going to say, first of all, what happens next, and then I'm going to turn to them. And I'm going to start with Drew, so, you know, but after that, it's a surprise. First of all, in 2 weeks' time, or so, thereabouts, you'll get the transcripts of all of these discussions. You'll see how embarrassing your questions have been, and how very embarrassing some of the answers have been. You'll also get the PowerPoints up on the web. And our very good friends, our hosts in the National Academies, will send you a note and let you know when that happens. So that will be kind of the immediate next step deliverable. But there are two other things as well, at least, that are going to come out of this meeting. One, as I think we mentioned yesterday, there will be a shorter, possibly slightly more targeted report, which in the first instance will be prepared by ourselves and the OECD together with the Royal Society, and of course in collaboration with our hosts in the National Academies. That will take a little bit longer to do, not least because the big bureaucracy in the room, or at least the difficult bureaucracy in the room, is the OECD, and we have certain procedures to go through. But in that, we want to try and come out with some recommendations. And really now, we want to try and get a sense of what some of these might be. And then in my own organisation, I can't speak for the others, we will take that report and the outcome from these discussions into our internal intergovernmental discussions, which are certainly not transparent and I'm sure are completely untrustworthy and don't involve the public at all, and definitely not society, even Paul's notion of society, and the OECD countries, we hope, will think about trying to identify where some of the areas for public policy which might be developed should be prioritised, and I hope work taken forward. So I've given you that introduction now because I really do want to stimulate all these august people here on the panel to come out with their reflections and their one, or if they've got two quick recommendations. And then once I've done that, we'll quickly see if there's any comments or additional points from the audience. And then, by then it will be 5 to 5, and we will be in crackerjack mode. So, Drew, I'm going to start with you.
I'm a poor surrogate for Ed Lazowska, who gave me this piece of paper to read to you, which I'm now not allowed to do. And I'll thus paraphrase it by starting with two quotes and make one thing and be done. We reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code. So says Dave Clark and the Internet Engineering Task Force. Let's get it done. And then a quote about Ed from his webpage, if you've not seen it. If you're not part of the steamroller, you're part of the road. So to paraphrase Ed, the last positive integer number of years have demonstrated the promise of synthetic biology, and it is now our challenge to achieve this promise. And this requires getting stuff done. Focused investments in technology, science, and policy, and pulling it off. I return the remainder of my time to the chair for use by the honorable gentleman from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Well, there we go. Well, so, Drew, from you, I'm going to move on next to Sheila.
Thank you. I guess what I'm struck by is that we've been debating two utterly different things. One is an emerging technology and how we get it out of the heads of people like Drew and get it into making money for us, which we desperately need as societies. And the other is how to construct a public sphere in the 21st century in which science and technology play incredibly important roles and in which we do a lot of the work of governance through science and technology and not only through things like law, which we're kind of used to doing. So my recommendations under each heading would therefore be rather different. So with regard to the point about emerging technologies, I think there's a lot of lack of clarity about how the experience and knowledge from other emerging technologies is being drawn upon and used. And so I would suggest that in thinking about all these quite technical issues that have come up about regulation, about the nature of intellectual property law, about the relationship with insurers, and so on and so forth, that a lot more thoughtful and clear drawing of the analogies to other emerging technologies around which we have had more discussion would be appropriate. And I thought that Bob Cook-Deegan's attempt to relate gene therapy to the discussion of synthetic biology was an example of the kind of scholarly and research-based and historically grounded analogizing that we should see more of. But when we talk about the other point, the construction of the public sphere, I think the discussion has been not particularly illuminating to somebody like me. So I would get more excited about Adam's use of the term science literacy if I didn't know that Seed Magazine actually did science literacy in much more like what I consider to be the right way to go about constructing the public sphere, in that it's not only sort of educating larger than 2% of the public about the nitty-gritties of particular scientific and technological developments. But if we want to think about making a public sphere, then the points on which I think we've walked in a gingerly fashion up to even framing them and not really gone there include globalization. How do we really get a global discourse going, given such things as language barriers that came up on day one, but people seem to have forgotten them? People seem to think that the only language barrier is between scientists and non-scientists. This is not the case. There are language barriers of all kinds. You do not, according to political theory, get a good public sphere unless people are capable of speaking the same language. So that's something to be taken very, very seriously, especially in a globalizing world. Scientists are not aware of the fact that what they do is not mere play and fun and sports, but also governance. I mean, this is a point that really needs to be got across. The fact is that you can, by technological means, control people in much the same way that you do through law, and yet the system of governance we have in place for technology is not the system of governance we have in place for constitutional law. So I think once one recognizes that technological innovation is a very deep going way of changing the very circumstances in which people live, then it becomes a challenging multilateral and ongoing progressive discussion how we're going to channel that innovative capacity in a progressive direction. I think many people have commented on the fact that this does need to be a progressive thing and not a punctual, one-shot, decisionistic, solution-oriented thing. How we engage in those ongoing conversations is, again, something to think about. And I think the OECD countries have the resources, but they don't put them to good use in thinking about them.
Thanks, Sheila. And certainly for me, one of the themes that struck me over the last 2 days was the one of inclusiveness and trust and bringing in a broader body of opinion, a broader body of awareness. And I don't use the word understanding here necessarily, because I'm not quite sure what understanding means, into governance decision-making and shaping the way that we harness and use these technologies. And I was struck this afternoon, by the way, by this point I think Bob Cook-Diggan made about high-tech fatigue. I mean, this is certainly one of the challenges that we have. We have, I think, now three different sorts of working party in biotechnology, two different sorts of working party in nanotechnology, and that's just in one organization. I really hope we don't end up with a working party in synthetic biology. Unless, of course, is to start to think about some of these framework conditions. And one of the other things that struck me, Carolyn, I'm going to turn to you momentarily, was the demand for investment in tools and techniques. So I really appreciate your thoughts.
Yes. So just a first comment. One of the things that I've really been struck by over the last couple days is this dynamic tension between the complexity of driving investment and global regulation of these technologies in contrast to the fact that this is being driven by large groups of excited young people who don't have the foggiest idea, generally, of such issues. So there's a real issue here of how do we keep them interested and engaged and yet still educate them about the real impact that they will have as they continue their career as synthetic biologists. And I think the first stabs that iGEM is making are part of the solution in terms of scientific literacy. That's one thing. As your question about tools and techniques, so one of the very clear things I think you'll see throughout the community, again, as Christina said so eloquently, is this gap between what people want in terms of applications and the real need for basic investments in both tools and techniques. The fact of the matter is that most of the scientists doing this work spend 80% of their time pipetting liquids from test tube A to test tube B. So we really need to go ahead and make investments in being able to not only synthesize DNA cheaply, but also to be able to combine it in many different, in a combinatorial way, so that we can actually go on and do the business of synthetic biology more quickly. Accompanying that is, of course, investment in standards and basic tools. And we need to put in both the resources, not only in terms of money, but also in terms of rewards in publishing and advancement to really propagate these technical innovations.
Thanks, Carolyn. I was also struck by a lovely paper that Drew and Ed just passed to me this afternoon, and it's a title in it which gets the metaphor prize from the OECD for this year, Tools of Mass Construction. It's just absolutely beautiful. But I think that's kind of the message, isn't it? It really captures this. Now, let's turn to some of the applications rather than the tools. Unfortunately, Jim Greenwood's not around, but Dick Kitney is. And I'm going to turn to you, Dick, just to give us a sense of not just the health and medicine angles, but your perception more generally on applications and indeed your key messages from this meeting.
Well, thank you, Ian. So in terms of application areas, we looked at this problem in terms of our Royal Academy of Engineering report. It is, of course, quite difficult to predict what's going to happen over the next 25 years, but some of the developments which may occur are certainly new types of biomaterials that we think are going to come about from synthetic biology, leading to the ability to create, for example, new types of tissue. Other examples are advanced biosensors, where you can think of biosensors, for example, in the bloodstream that can attack arterial plaque and potentially have the ability to release drugs, etc. Then I think another very important area, which we haven't really touched on in this meeting, is the developments in a number of laboratories, both on both sides of the Atlantic, of the the biological equivalent to computer gates. I mean, somebody, actually it was Christina, I think, in her presentation talked about AND gates, etc. And that's certainly something that we're very interested in because, you know, we can see the whole development of the equivalent to digital devices, but biologically based. And when you think about putting those inside cells, for example, that becomes extremely exciting by way of biosensors. In more general terms, I think it's Bob Winston yesterday who quoted Lord Kelvin, who in 1895 predicted that heavier than air flight would not be possible, and 8 years later the Wright brothers achieved it. And I think for me the message there is slightly different, which is the problem with the Wright brothers is that nobody told them that you can't fly. And I think that's the issue here in terms of, for example, iGEM and the whole field of synthetic biology. I believe that nobody has told us you can't do a lot of this stuff, and we're actually going out there and doing it collectively. So I think that's very important. Next, a lot of comments have been made about, you know, why engineering? Why are we taking this engineering approach? Well, of course, as many of you in the room know, I'm an engineer. And I would argue that the reason we're doing this is because this is the way forward through into hopefully this really exciting new future of industrialization using synthetic biology methods. And one thing also that I think people haven't touched on here are the close parallels, I would argue, between synthetic chemistry in the middle of the 19th century and synthetic biology today. And if you look at the development of synthetic chemistry in the 19th century through to the 20th century, you can see quite clearly that it was the basis of many of the major industries of the 20th century, including the microelectronics industry of today. So that's why I think that there are pretty close parallels. And that's why it may not work, but the reason why people are focusing, like Drew, etc., and ourselves on the engineering approach is because this is the way through to industrialization. In terms of recommendations, I feel quite passionately actually that the way forward here, this is probably a no-brainer, but the way forward here is that we need around the world to create a number of sort of really key centers in universities which combine not only research in synthetic biology but also teaching, in other words, programs that based on masters leading through to PhDs, where the researchers and the students interact within a single centre. And I think that's extremely important. I have to say it's what we're already doing at Imperial College, so I probably would say that, but I nevertheless think it is a very important development. And finally, I think it's very exciting that we've had this meeting, actually, because, you know, although I know a lot of people on the United States side of synthetic biology, and obviously the community within Europe, for the first time, I think we've actually, through the OECD, the Royal Society, etc., managed to bring all these people together into, you know, what is a common meeting and hopefully in the future a common community. Thank you.
Thanks, Dick. And I must say, and just to comment on what you said there, one of the things that struck me looking at the various emerging technologies is I've been impressed by how I think probably realistic people have been about expectations and timeframes, both in the Royal Academy of Engineering's report, but in the discussions here. I mean, sometimes we tend to throw ourselves into the hype and to say, you know, what we can and what we will do, and then the delivery doesn't match the promise. But it seems to me to be a much more measured and thoughtful debate that we've had in the past few days. Except, of course, in iGEM, which is going to change the world, Randy, isn't it?
Already has.
What?
That's true.
iGEM is certainly changing the world. It's and it's also, iGEM is changing the field, because what we have is kids who have a different point of view, different approaches. I was thinking about the speakers in the last session who were talking about the change in the press, in the media. And then I was realizing that, of course, in iGEM, I have about 1,000 students. Those students are very young. They are completely fluent in the internet. And I make them go and make web pages about their projects so they can tell everybody about them. And they tell everybody. They put blogs. They put pictures of themselves. They put pictures of the parties that they have during iGEM. They they put videos of the activities they do. So they are, in fact, creating their own news reports about the development of synthetic biology. And one of my tasks is to make sure that 40, 50 years from now, you can still get access to those websites. That's become, I feel, a little bit of an obligation to capture that history and not simply power it down or install a new version of the operating system and destroy it all. For me, this meeting has grown on me. It started off with some very pleasant discussions, and then I felt that there was a bit of a gloom that descended as we all had to worry. And we didn't know how much we had to worry. Maybe we had to worry a lot, but we should start worrying soon and in many languages. And so that was very discouraging. And fortunately, we've gotten past that a bit, and I have come to realize that quite a few of the people who are involved in the policy work here, I think perhaps because the policy actions that they take actually have effect, they take those actions seriously. And so I'm optimistic about that. There is a piece that I think I see that maybe many other people don't see, and that is their presumptions about how technology develops. And the presumptions in the purest form and most incorrect form is that scientists test a hypothesis in the lab. When they have that all worked out, then some engineer comes up and measures the market opportunity of that scientific discovery and then forms a company to take advantage of that. In my experience as being an entrepreneur and being in industrial environments, what I find is that the entrepreneurs are crazy and that they fall in love with the ideas and they just want to make it happen. And everything else about how much money you're going to make, what the market is, and all of that is all added on later. And I think that's a wonderful way to do it. And so the discussion in the last session about explaining to everybody how science really has vast amounts of uncertainty in it, it takes a path that appears to be somewhat of a directed random walk is all just great. So in terms of the things that I've learned in this and things that have been different, it's been that the regulatory part, I think, has been focused on how the scientists will pay more attention to the public, how the scientists will pay more attention to the risks and the ethical issues and the humanity. But I'd like to suggest that the people in the regulatory side need to, again, understand that we have a brand new field that's starting up, and the excitement and the opportunity of that field is overwhelming. And the time frame is really not 5 years. The internet has been around with us for 40 years. We didn't have the World Wide Web until about 25 years into the internet. It came in around 95, and the internet started around 1970. So if you had looked at the internet, say, 10 years in, you would have said, oh, it's file transfer and email. That's it. And email hadn't penetrated very well. So I think the right time frame is to think of this in kind of a 40-year time frame and say, that's enough time to have learned many things. We have to get there safely. We have to get there with some bumps, but that's our goal. In terms of the recommendations, I think that the biggest recommendation I would make is that we are carrying quite a few presumptions, and we're hoping that we don't have to change them as this world of synthetic biology changes. We're holding a presumption about stated clearly, and again, I think incorrectly, innovation doesn't happen unless you own patents. And I think that's clearly, cleanly wrong. Innovation happens when you share. When you have the patents, then you don't have to innovate so much. So the entire issue of the patent and legal framework, I think, needs to be a bit reconsidered. I like the discussion about comparing synthetic biology to the semiconductor industry, where new things had to be worked out. And I believe that that is almost certainly the case with synthetic biology. I can't imagine that the current model will be, that synthetic biology can in fact be successful in the current model of strict patents and high charges. So I think that has to happen. Then the next thing I think that has to happen is that the field is still extremely young. I think the practitioners in the field will have a very difficult time getting money from the funding agencies, because they will run into things like peer review, where 9 out of 10 of the people doing the reviews will have a completely different point of view. And I think that the sooner the different areas in the world come to understand that this is in fact an important and serious thing and that it has to be dealt with in that light in terms of the funding, I think the better off we'll be.
Thanks, Randy. And for me, the IP question and the innovation exploitation model here is particularly exciting but also challenging in synthetic bio. To one of the first of the true convergent technologies, bringing together the different disciplines of engineering and different applications of science. And what that model actually looks like is something which certainly I will take a powerful message back to our constituents, saying it's something which should be explored more. The role of patents, the role of other IPs in that, I think that's one that we need to debate. I think the other point here that really struck me was the non-linearity of some of the innovation practice here. And that's something which, in my day job, one of the things that I run is called OECD's Working Party on Technology Innovation Policy, the TIP, which has pioneered much of the shift away from linear to innovation system thinking over the last 20 years. But when we look at policies, although we talk about innovation system thinking, we still see a linear policy response. And the synthetic bio issue is really one that challenges that, which is a very clumsy segue into beginning to think about policy and the safety and security issues. So, Helga, would you like to comment?
Yeah. One thing that struck me while listening to the presentations over 2 days is how strong a certain fear seems to be that the public could turn hostile, either on the ground of risks emerging or on other reasons that have to do with possibly wrong way of interfere or of doing public outreach activities. Coming from a country where we have a fierce biotechnology debate, we've had that for 20 years now, I've been into many debates and many events that dealt with a seemingly hostile public. And listening to what has been said about synthetic biology here and now, I think that synthetic biology may be different. And taking up what Sheila said, yes, of course, you can and you should learn from past experiences. But please do not take it for granted that there will be a public controversy or something like that over synthetic biology. It can't be taken for granted. There's no reason to believe that. Controversies are very much dependent on contingent factors, on a particular point in time, a situation in a particular country. They mostly have to do with things entirely different and remote from the technology at stake. Concerning the recommendation, yes, I think you should and you ought to go out and talk to the public to make it clear what the challenges are, what the opportunities are, who is involved, try to build trust, but please don't do that in order to prevent the public becoming hostile, because if you do that, I can bet it will. Thank you.
Wow, clear words of warning there. I think that's a good segue, Mike, to you, and then we'll come to Matthew last.
I wanted to first of all, I think what we heard was that this is an extraordinarily broad technology, and we really don't know what will end up surfacing first in a public way, and that that may have a large impact on the way that the public perceives this technology. Again, the framing issue about whether it's seen as new or whether it's seen as simply an extension of technologies that we've been comfortable with for a long time. Given that breadth, I think the notion that several people have raised, including Sheila, that we need to be cautious about applying what we think are the lessons from the past. That this may be different. We need to both have a more nuanced understanding of how past episodes with public perceptions have actually created problems, and how this will actually apply to this specific technology. It sort of reminds me of the old Woody Allen joke about, they're talking about the lessons of Vietnam, and Woody Allen said, yes, the lessons of Vietnam is never get involved in a land war in Southeast Asia. So if the issue is we don't do biology anymore, that's probably the wrong lesson. I think the second point is that a communication strategy is not the same thing as dialogue and engagement, and that there has to be more than a simple one-way communication effort that goes on here, and that, frankly, I think the United States has much to learn from some of the European efforts as we think about our own engagement here. Third point is that trust is socially constructed. It can be created, it has to be earned, but the point is that it's also easily lost, and once lost is very difficult to get back. And I think that leads to a fourth point, is that what happens anywhere happens everywhere today. So that if there's an accident in Europe, that will affect the United States. If there's an accident in the Philippines, that will affect Europe. If there's opposition in one part of the world, it will happen everywhere. So there needs to be, at the same time that we are thinking about how we globally connect research, we also need to be thinking about how we globally connect engagement with the public, for which there may be some new models and new opportunities. So I think the issue of public participation captures very much the theme of the conference, of both opportunities and challenges.
And from the table here, Matthew, you get the last words.
Yes, I'm not my more glamorous colleague, James Wilson, who's gone off to sci-fi at Google. So you get me instead, but I'm sure that he would concur with what I'm about to say. The Royal Society, part of our motivation behind co-organising this particular symposium was to help crystallise our thoughts around synthetic biology. And we're quite keen to move from questions to start working on and helping others, I'm sure, work towards answers to some of the... I mean, the questions will never end cropping up, but we want to actually start working on some answers, and I'm sure there's many in this room who would like to do the same. But as we think through which particular answers we might be able to provide, I need to think about which particular questions are amenable to policy interventions. Some questions are not. And as a secondary supplement to that, which of those questions might the Royal Society actually be able to help with, and which ones might we be able to intervene with? Now, I'm going to stick my neck out and pick two things which have been cropping up during this symposium that I don't think we can intervene on, but I'm happy to be told otherwise. One which hasn't come up too often is the question of standards. I see that as an incredibly technical and important issue, but I'm not quite sure it's one which is amenable to policy intervention. Happy, again, to be corrected, but that's certainly a technical debate which I'll watch with much interest, but if someone knows a policy intervention which might help, I'm happy to hear it. But that's probably not something that we'll focus on. I was extremely grateful to Rick, who I'm not sure he's in the room, but yesterday for finally bringing the elephant and sticking it on a slide for me, the elephant in the room being the intellectual property topography, which I kind of knew was complicated, but I had no idea it was that staggeringly complicated. I'm not quite sure on that particular case that the Royal Society has the expertise to resolve that one. But I think I will move on to some things which I think we could assist on. My first thought, and this is kind of my recommendation, is to immediately investigate international and indeed national actually, but and international collaboration and cooperation around the oversight, the governance and the regulatory environment for synthetic biology. I think the Royal Society is well placed. We have, along with other partners, we have a couple of functions which we could play up to. Royal Society and similar entities work as useful, honest brokers on an international stage. But we can be more than that. We can actually be powerful policy analysts and indeed generate policy recommendations. And so that's certainly an action which I'll take away with me, and we are indeed already in conversations with international partners, potential partners, collaborators, and so on and so forth, and taking forward that agenda. Possibly falling under that very, very broad heading, and a couple of other things. Terry Taylor, International Council for Life Sciences, has already mentioned some of our work on the security aspects, but perhaps slightly different to many of the other synthetic biology discussions around the security aspects, and that's, I think, Helga, you even mentioned this yesterday, the attempt to unite the biosecurity, well, the full spectrum of risk from biosafety through to biosecurity, and having synthetic biology as a component of a much broader spectrum of analysis of risk. Something that we will be taking forward, and of course, I think that falls under the oversight regulation governance theme. The other one for which we've gained some reputation in the UK is the public engagement agenda, which has been possibly the most recurrent theme for the last 2 days. And we had some fun yesterday when we found out how many people don't know what a fossil fuel is. I think we all need to remind ourselves that you only have expertise with respect to a particular domain of knowledge or skill, and it's quite easy to make someone look an idiot by asking them a question about which they don't have any expertise. I'd rather return to Sheila's perfectly pitched challenge yesterday, that really we need to actually ask who gets to imagine the future of science, and that doesn't necessarily need the detailed understanding and the expertise of a synthetic biologist to help us understand who gets to think through and imagine the future of science. So Paul gave us the challenge to drop the word public, but I'd replace it with the less passive and much more active word citizen. I don't know why we can't use that. People who are active participants in a political and social culture. And so we need to find mechanisms by which we can invite citizens to engage with the innovation agenda of synthetic biology, not just as ethical litmus tests. So I don't know an iGen team yet which has decided to bring non-scientists onto their iGen team to imagine what innovations, collaboratively imagine innovations which might be possible with synthetic biology. That's the kind of imagination which I'm talking about involving citizens. I wasn't making that as a recommendation that we're going to try and involve citizens, but I don't know. We could explore that agenda. I think it's an important one.
Okay, so it sounds to me that the Royal Society is going to enter an iGEM team, and Matthew's going to be on it. Which I think you're a bit old, mate. But hey, why not? Ladies and gentlemen, this is your last chance to make an intervention before I close out. I'm not encouraging you to, but I don't want to stop you, Sally. Like Sally. Piers, Yanis, Paul, go to microphone, because otherwise you won't get on the transcript.
I think that was the most incredible sort of overview of all of the broad discussions that fall sort of under the chapeau of synthetic biology that I've ever come across in half an hour. But there was one thing that struck me as not being on that list, and I want to get it in there. It's the question of professional societies. You know, you have very nascent industry and already two industry associations. I know there have been discussions over an institute of synthetic biology or a society of professionals, and I think that's as a governance option worth having on the table, even if it's abandoned.
Okay, thank you, Yanis.
Just a small addition to come to Matthew's comments on standards. Tell you just an activity that's undercoming now. On my talk, I alluded to the ECUS Task Force on Biotechnology Research, and there is, without having a formal working group on that, as Ian said, not another working group on OECD, but we have a working relationship with the colleagues of the NSF. And we're trying to think to bring scholars from both sides of the Atlantic together to think how we can establish in a meaningful scientific way standards and which can help this community to go forward with their work. But still, this is, let's say, a very early advertisement. But since the word standards were mentioned, and really we have that in our mind, and we're trying to work, and soon you're going to get some news from us. Thank you.
And I agree with you, Yanis. I think there's a lot the international community can do to move standards forward. Paul?
I would like to just follow up on James's comment, which I really appreciated. And we've been talking about what is enlightenment, or a small essay by Kant, or at least that theme. He also wrote an essay on an idea for universal history with cosmopolitan intent. And so we citizens is much better than publics and society, but it's cosmopolitan citizens in a global world and not nationalist citizens fighting each other. So I thank you for that.
And the final comment from the audience.
Alan, and as Sally's employee, who's confident that the regulators will be brought into the discussion, my recommendation to the synthetic biology community would be to actually remember something that one of our colleagues from Health Canada said yesterday about the difficulties of defining the boundaries in this area, because having gone through this process of trying to define boundaries in the context of our regulations myself, it's very challenging. And what strikes me is that it's really too simple to say, you know, as some might say, well, the issues are now or in the next few years, and it's too simple to say it's decades off. The field is broad. It encompasses a lot of different kinds of activities. It's my perception that there are debates within the field about what's counted as synthetic biology, what's not. So if the synthetic biology community can help the regulators define what some of those boundaries are, where we are now and where we are heading over what kind of time frame, that, and do this repeatedly over as the field evolves over the years, I think that's going to make a very big contribution in that aspect. I suspect it will also make a contribution to public or citizen engagement as well.
I do hope so. Any burning final comments from the panel? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to give the last words to Ed Lazowska, who left me some notes here. And I'm not going to read out all of it, although I'd like to, but I'm going to read out two paragraphs of it. And it's this: during this decade, we've demonstrated the promise that we will someday be able to engineer biology at scale, to develop and deploy biology as a technology to address societal challenges such as energy, disease, and nourishment. The challenge for us now is to achieve that promise. This will require a concerted and coordinated effort on both technology and policy fronts. And I think that you will want to join with me in thanking the moderators, the speakers, and perhaps most of all, the unsung hero of this, Anna Maria Mazza and her team, the organizers here in the National Academies, for this really excellent meeting. Please join me in congratulating. Save Jordi's home.